Welcome back, True Crime Army. I am your host, Margot, and this is Military Murder, a show where I focus on crimes committed by military members and veterans. But don't worry, you don't have to know anything about the military to listen, I promise. You just have to be a true crime enthusiast, and if that's you, welcome home. Today's story is one of the most insane modern stories I had heard in a while. Like, I swear, when I think about today's case, it almost appears in my mind like on a news channel, on one of those TVs that you had to walk up to change the channel with knobs and antennas and stuff. I know. But seriously, today's case was a listener-suggested case, and it involves a bus full of kids, a kidnapping in broad daylight, a seven-day hostage negotiation, and an underground bunker in 2013. Think about it. That was just 11 years ago. It finally occurred to me that I hadn't heard about this story because during the time that this was taking place, I was finishing up my tour in Afghanistan when everything went down. But today's case was on national news. Now, today's topic is near and dear to my heart as my kid's bus driver was recently rerouted, leaving us all guessing as to when the substitute bus driver would arrive in the mornings. But anyway, in addition to being grateful for teachers who put up with all them kids, including mine, can we give props to bus drivers who put up with all the kids at the end of the day? I know because I swear my two sweet angels come off the bus looking like they just got home from moving rocks from one side of the field to the other. I'm like, is everything okay? Shoot, when I was a kid, I was happy to be home at the end of the day. Not my kids. I have to ramp myself up for their arrival at the end of every day. Anyway, in today's story, I want to remember a bus driver by the name of Chuck Poland, who protected the kids on his bus as if they were his own. Join me today as I tell you the story of a crazed veteran by the name of Jimmy Lee Dykes. Now, let's dig in.
Military Murder is an independent project and is not endorsed by the Department of Defense or any military component. The views expressed are those of the host. The content of this podcast is not meant to be legal or medical advice. Warning, this episode contains graphic details of murder and is not suitable for young listeners. Listener discretion is advised.
Our story today takes place in Midland City, Alabama, a town in the southeast corner of the state with a little over 2,000 residents. On the afternoon of Monday, January 28, 2013, school bus driver Chuck Poland was driving bus 04-2 with 22 students. They were all on their way home from school. Part of this route took Chuck about 350 yards up a rutted dirt road to drop off the kids that lived at the top of the rise. To avoid having to back up the bus downhill, the bus driver had to back the bus into a driveway to turn around. Before the Christmas break just weeks earlier, the driveway had been overgrown with weeds, making it kind of tough to turn the bus around. A man who lived there cleared it over the holidays so that it would be easier for the bus to turn around. The Good Samaritan was Jimmy Lee Dykes, and on that Monday afternoon, as the bus backed up, Dykes approached the bus door. Chuck opened the bus door and thanked Dykes. Dykes replied, "I figured you'd appreciate that." The man made some small talk, and Dykes asked Chuck if he wanted some broccoli and carrots. Chuck said yes, and Dykes said, "All right, great, I'll catch you tomorrow." The interaction was brief and cordial. As bus 04-2 began to drive off, all the nosy kids peppered Chuck with questions about the stranger they had just met. Chuck was like, "Settle down, kids. That man was a kind neighbor who mowed the lawn to allow the bus to pass more smoothly." If you've ever dealt with kids who are school-aged, you know they have questions about everything. But it was no biggie for Chuck because he truly loved kids. That night, Chuck went home and told his wife about his interactions with Dykes. Chuck said that he felt that Dykes was lonely and needed a friend. The following morning, Chuck brought a dozen fresh eggs and a jar of muscadine grape jelly with him. And when he got to the spot where Dykes lived, he dropped off the gifts on the front seat of Dykes' van, along with a note that read, quote, "I'm Chuck Poland, the school bus driver. Sorry I missed you. Left you some eggs and muscadine jelly on front seat of van for you. See you later, Chuck Poland." Chuck had included his phone number in the corner of the note. That afternoon, Tuesday, January 29th at 3:32 p.m., Chuck dropped the kids off at their stop at the top of the hill and backed the bus into the turnaround that Dykes had cleared. He looked out and saw Dykes approaching the bus with a plastic Walmart bag that appeared to be stuffed full of fresh broccoli. Chuck opened the bus door to let his new friend hand the sack of broccoli up. But instead, Dykes climbed onto the bus steps, and instead of handing over the broccoli, Dykes pulled a Ruger pistol on Chuck. Dykes then handed Chuck a handwritten note that read in part, quote, "I have a story to tell. I need two hostages to force the powers to be to listen. You will choose two small, well-mannered good kids, ages 6 to 10, preferably boys, with no physical, mental, medical problems. You will connect them at the wrist with this tie. Bring them forward. They and I will leave the bus. You will immediately drive down the road and call the law. No harm will come to the kids. When the story is finished, they will go free and then I will die. Do exactly as I say. Please do not make any wrong moves. I do not want to traumatize the kids any more than absolutely necessary. Now get this done as soon as possible. My cell phone number is," and then he gave the number, "My name is Jim Dykes. Take a deep breath. You can do this. Again, do not mess this up and no one will be harmed. P.S. Thanks, Chuck. I'm extremely sorry, but I have to do this. Please do not make me do something I don't want to do. Don't ask me anything. Don't tell me anything. Just do it quickly," end quote. Now that is a note. Despite having a gun pointed in his face and the note, Chuck kept his cool. He stayed in his seat and told the kids not to move. Meanwhile, kids scooched all the way down in their seats, peeking over to see what was happening.
I need two boys to take care of this bus.
He's scared.
You will not be harmed, son.
I'm sorry.
I'm gonna have to shoot now. Come on, I don't have any time. The goddamn law's coming. Come on.
I'm not sure if you could understand all that, but that was the audio recorded from the bus, and you can hear Dykes tell Chuck, quote, "I don't want to shoot you. I want two kids, 6 to 8 years old. I mean it right now. Two kids, 6 to 8 years old. Get it. Make a move. I'll shoot you. Do it." Chuck looked at Dykes and told him in an even voice, "You're going to have to shoot me." During the ordeal, one of the kids in the back, 16-year-old Trey Watts, secretly dialed 911. Dykes had the Ruger in one hand and a zip tie in the other. He tried to call some of the kids in the back to come forward up to him, but none of the kids moved, not even an inch. Then Dykes turned his attention to a little boy sitting right behind Chuck. The little boy didn't fit the bill of what Dykes was looking for, but he didn't care. The little boy sitting behind Chuck was 5-year-old Ethan Gilman. Ethan had autism and sat behind Chuck so that he was close to an adult if need be. You see, Ethan was terrified of steps, like actual steps and staircases. And Dykes started yelling at Ethan to come to him as Dykes stood on the very stairs that made Ethan scared. Ethan didn't move, frozen in complete fear. Dykes yelled at the terrified little boy, "Come on, come here, come on." Chuck told Dykes to leave Ethan alone, saying he's scared to death. Dykes kept his focus on little Ethan and said, "You will not be harmed, son." Chuck stayed steady and defiant to the imminent threat standing in front of him. Dykes turned his attention back to Chuck, and some reports indicate that Chuck got between Dykes and Ethan. That's when Dykes yelled, "I'm gonna have to shoot you now. Go on. I don't have any time. The goddamn law is coming. Come on, don't. Chuck replied in a quiet, steady voice, "I can't do it. I can't." During the entire exchange, Chuck remained calm and didn't let the kids move. Suddenly, a shot rang out. Dykes had pulled the trigger and shot Chuck Poland in the chest. Chuck let out a cry. Then, as the bus rolled backwards through the trees in the turnaround, Dykes pulled the trigger 4 more times, hitting Chuck at close range. Chuck fell against the side window, dead in the driver's seat, as the bus rolled to a stop. It had only been a few seconds from the time that Dykes boarded the bus until Chuck Poland was killed in front of a bus full of kids. Meanwhile, in the back of the bus, Trey Watts was still on the phone with 911 that captured the entire thing. The operator could hear the children screaming in the background and asked Trey, "Oh my gosh, what's going on?"
"Oh my gosh, what's going on?"
"Hey,
what?
What happened then?"
"Oh my gosh, hang in there, baby, hang in there. Just get down, get down."
"The bus driver's dead," Trey said. "The what? The bus driver's dead." "Hang in there, baby, hang in there," Miss Norris told him. "Just get down." Once Chuck was dead, Dykes reached behind Chuck's body in the seat and hoisted little Ethan from his seat and dragged him down the stairs. Dykes then threw Ethan over his shoulder and walked from the bus. A little girl cried out, "Mama, Mommy!" Two girls bravely approached the front of the bus and screamed at Chuck, "Mr. Poland, Mr. Poland!" But Chuck didn't respond. The kids scrambled off of the bus and ran down the dirt road to the main road and to a church that was on the corner. Meanwhile, Dykes reached his property and somehow got Ethan down a ladder into a hole in the ground. At the bottom of the ladder was a bunker stocked with survival staples like water and food, but also equipped with a phone. Dykes picked up the phone and dialed 911. Gasping for breath after being winded from carrying little Ethan, because I haven't told you this, but Dykes is a 65-year-old man. Well, he made the trek from the bus and he told the dispatcher, "I have a hostage. I'm in an underground bunker." For some reason, the call was cut off and Dykes immediately called 911 again. He told the dispatcher that the police could talk to him, but only through a white PVC pipe that was by the front gate. The bunker itself was about 170 feet from the pipe behind a beat-up trailer, a shipping container, and Dykes' conversion van where Chuck Poland had kindly left the eggs and jam that morning. The trailer was actually a beat-up leftover van from a federal disaster relief program, and that was where Dykes was living. The property was on an acre and a half and was accessed through cattle gates on the driveway where Chuck turned the bus around. The property was landscaped with cinder blocks and had a pond and a garden. And I say landscaped, but loosely, because it's just really covered in shrubs and not really developed. The bunker was situated underneath a mound of dirt and reinforced on one side by a cinder block wall that was about waist high. To get to the entrance of the bunker, you went down a short set of cement block steps where you were met with a heavy wooden hatch that was about 2 feet by 4 feet in size. One of the first police officers on the scene was Sheriff's Deputy Lieutenant Bill Rafferty from nearby Houston County. He located the PVC pipe and made contact with Dykes through it. The pipe was 4 inches wide and came straight up 5 feet out of the ground where it turned 90 degrees, kind of like a periscope. Lieutenant Rafferty could hear Dykes through the pipe. Dykes told him that if the police tried to take the bunker by force, there would be a loud boom. Dykes also asked Lieutenant Rafferty if Chuck Poland had survived. Rafferty knew that Chuck had died, but told Dykes he wasn't sure. Dykes answered, "If he had just done what I told him to, I wouldn't have had to shoot him." As the minutes went by, more and more police joined Lieutenant Rafferty on Dykes' property, including more sheriff's department deputies, city police, and state troopers. Before long, they were joined by SWAT teams and the first of many FBI agents and a hostage negotiator that arrived around 8 p.m. Less than an hour after the entire team was there, Dykes told them he was done talking for the night. Despite Dykes' refusal to speak, however, the investigation didn't stop. They started by interviewing Dykes' neighbor, Michael Creel, who gave them some insight into the recluse. Michael told investigators that Dykes gave him a ride to Walmart about a year earlier, and that he spent the entire ride to town ranting about a new gun law. On their way back from Walmart, Dykes told Michael about taking people hostage in a church some Sunday, hoping that a reporter would broadcast his views about the gun law. Michael responded by telling Dykes that no one would listen to a man holding hostages. At that point, they spent the remaining time driving in silence. I guess Dykes didn't like what Michael had to say. It didn't mean that Dykes didn't like Michael. You see, later in the year, Dykes offered Michael a job helping him build a bunker. Dykes told Michael it was a storm shelter. He told him that he used to live in Florida and had survived several hurricanes. Michael agreed and took the job. Together, the men worked for weeks on the red Alabama clay. Once they dug it out, they built walls that were supported with joists and lined with wood panels. When they were done, Dykes had Michael climb down into the bunker and, quote, scream real loud, I want to see if I can hear you, end quote. Then Dykes walked away. Michael didn't think anything of it. He figured that Dykes wanted to see if he could be heard in case a tree fell on the bunker. Michael was hooting and hollering and was perplexed to find out that Dykes was happy that he couldn't hear Michael yelling through the ground from the outside. Michael told investigators that once he was done, Dykes continued to work on the bunker for at least another year, maybe more. Michael was able to provide a description of the interior, describing that underneath the hatch was a wooden ladder that went down a narrow shaft into a small entry area. Beyond that was the main part of the bunker, a 6-foot by 8-foot box that was just tall enough for an adult to stand straight up. After speaking to Michael, investigators learned about an incident where Dykes got into a tiff with another neighbor over the ownership of some pecans that fell from the neighbor's tree onto the road. A deputy responded to Dykes' complaint, but it really wasn't about the pecans at all. Dykes felt like this was just one more reason why he felt the world was against him. During that police response, Dykes told the deputy, quote, all the boys at the top, they shit on all the people at the bottom, end quote. I mean, this is really confusing. I went back and watched what was going on with the pecans, and basically what had happened was the pecan tree belonged to a neighbor, but it was like poking over the street and all the pecans fell on the road. Well, Dykes wanted to pick up the pecans for himself, and his neighbors told him that they were his pecans. Anyway, I don't know how everything was settled, but Dykes was upset, so I'm assuming he didn't get to keep the pecans. On to more bizarreness. According to one neighbor, Dykes liked to bet on dog races and kept boxes and boxes of records of the races. He hoped he could study the race files and find a pattern and then one day get rich on his winnings. But that never happened because he thought the government was working with the mafia to control the dogs. Get this. Dykes thought that the dogs were implanted with a microchip that the government put in them that they could use to shock the dogs remotely and slow them down. That way, you never won, and the racetrack didn't have to pay out. All I have to say about that is, woof. So, you might be wondering, had Dykes ever been arrested? Well, yes, he had. You see, Dykes collected a bit of a record over the years, including arrest for drugs, drunk driving, assault, and larceny. He was due to face a judge on January 30th, 2013, the day after the shooting, but obviously wasn't going to be making it since he was holed up in his bunker with a 5-year-old hostage. The reason for his latest court appearance? It was to face a misdemeanor charge for building an illegal speed bump to slow down a neighbor's sports car. The dispute about the bump led to an altercation where Dykes pulled a gun on the speeding neighbor. This is all very scary, and honestly, these neighbor feuds should be taken seriously. There was a recent double homicide by a veteran who was confronted by two ladies on the HOA for noise, and it was truly tragic. Okay, so back to the no kidding day of this investigation. So it's 9 p.m. when Dykes announced that he was done talking to investigators. After that, investigators worked on trying to figure out how to see or hear what was happening down inside the bunker. They thought maybe they could thread some sort of camera or a microphone down that PVC pipe. FBI agent Mike Harris got down on the ground lying in the dirt to get a close-up look at the pipe. It was around midnight, and there was another FBI agent, a negotiator, sitting in a folding chair right there in case Dykes decided he wanted to talk. As Agent Harris examined the PVC pipe, he spotted something inside the pipe. He told the negotiator, there's something in this pipe. Not knowing if it was a bomb, the bomb squad brought over an X-ray machine and scanned the piece of PVC pipe sticking up. I can only imagine the cold chill that crawled up their backs when they realized that there was a bomb inside the pipe. The X-ray revealed that it was made up of gunpowder and shotgun pellets. The trigger was a cord that ran the length of the pipe and went down into the bunker. There could only be one reason for this booby trap, right? Dykes wanted to kill responding law enforcement. Investigators now realized that if there was one booby trap, there could have been more. As they scanned the area around them, they saw more than a dozen PVC pipes poking up from the ground. It was like a minefield. Thankfully, the bomb squad cleared them when they discovered that Dykes was using them to support plants that he was growing. The discovery of the bomb in the communications pipe caused the first responders to pivot and change their tactics. They couldn't just sit around this PVC pipe all day waiting for Dykes to come talk. So the first thing they did in the morning was they evacuated the neighbors, and the FBI moved the negotiator and the chair away from the pipe and replaced them with a speaker and a microphone on a stand next to the pipe so agents could still communicate with Dykes from a safe distance and without letting Dykes know that they were aware of his booby trap. Later that day, on January 30th, a plane with blacked-out windows landed in nearby Dothan. A steady stream of FBI agents and employees filed off, including criminal profilers, handlers with bomb-sniffing and attack dogs, technicians, crisis managers, and members of the FBI hostage rescue team. The decision was made to set up a joint command team at the church at the bottom of the hill. The team was made up of the county sheriff, a state police officer, and the FBI agent in charge, Steve Richardson. They would make all major decisions pertaining to the investigation and response from this joint location. The hostage rescue team set up across the street from the church in an empty building. If negotiations failed, the team would be sent in to retrieve Ethan. However, they all realized that this situation, a bunker with a hostage, didn't match any scenarios that the FBI had ever seen before. For starters, the bunker wasn't built with a building permit. You know, you usually get a building permit and it's kept with the county planning division, so you kind of know what it looks like. There weren't any windows that would allow a sniper to take Dykes out from a distance, and at this point, the FBI was quite a bit stumped. They started gathering intel on both Dykes and little Ethan, the victim. The investigators learned that Ethan had a tough time in his short 5 years of life. You see, his mother had addiction issues with drugs and alcohol and had lost custody of little Ethan. He had autism and was on several medications that helped him manage his behavior. Without the medications, he could become unruly. It's unclear to me from all the research who Ethan was staying with at the time that he was kidnapped. Negotiators talked to Dykes via the microphone/speaker/PVC pipe communication system and got him to agree to allow them to deliver some items for Ethan. Agents dropped off a package with coloring books, crayons, toys, and most importantly, Ethan's medications at the entrance to the bunker. When Dykes cracked open the hatch to retrieve Ethan's items, the FBI was able to get a look at how the hatch was secured. Dykes had rigged steel bicycle lock cables strung from eye bolts in the hatch to the ladder that led down to the bunker. Dykes had to loosen the cables to allow the hatch to open. Agents also talked Dykes into accepting a direct line called a throw phone into his hidey hole. Dykes took the phone with him and duct taped it to the wall inside the bunker. The throw phone would allow the FBI negotiators to talk to Dykes directly with clear communication and at any time. Because, you know, quite honestly, relying on the PVC/speaker/microphone setup was kind of sketchy. They knew the pipe was rigged and it was extremely dangerous. Plus, being outside in the wind and rain made an already hard-to-understand conversation even worse. The sheriff's deputy, Lieutenant Rafferty, and the lead FBI negotiator began to talk to Dykes to learn more about his demands. Dykes told them he wanted a female TV reporter to come to the bunker and he would let Ethan go. Dykes assured everybody that the reporter would be there to help him deliver his manifesto to the world. He told negotiators that when he was done broadcasting his message, he would put a plastic bag over his head and fill it with helium. The female reporter would hold his hand while he suffocated to death. First off, what woman would want to willingly go down into a hole with an unhinged person who shot a bus driver and kidnapped a five-year-old? And then the person would have to hold Dyke's hand while he committed suicide in a horribly torturous way. I'll tell you who, an undercover FBI agent, that's who. Over the course of the day, the FBI was able to sneak a tiny camera into the bunker. They couldn't see much, but they could see a triple-high bunk bed, a blue tarp that had a bucket that they used as a toilet behind it. They could see Dykes, and most importantly, they could see little Ethan. Toward the end of the afternoon, a female FBI agent got on a throw phone with Dykes. The negotiator introduced her as a reporter from an internet news channel. When the undercover agent asked Dykes how he was doing, he sounded like he was on the verge of crying. He said, "I've seen better days. This hasn't been very easy on me either." Dykes talked to the undercover agent for a few minutes, explaining that it would take several days to say everything he had to say and explain his views. They ended the call before any firm plans or schedule was made for an actual interview. A few hours later, the negotiator found himself on the receiving end of Dykes' anger. Somehow, Dykes had figured out that the female reporter was a fraud, and he was pissed. Agents weren't sure how he found out, but their concern about his stability was steadily growing. Dykes asked them, "It was all lies, wasn't it?" And then Dykes refused to talk to the FBI any longer. The team was now 72 hours into Ethan's abduction since Dykes had ceased communication with the FBI negotiator. At that point, they decided to let Lieutenant Rafferty try to engage over the throw phone. With a little patience, Rafferty was able to get Dykes to start to talk again. Their conversations were hours long and drifted between subjects that Dykes felt were important, like trucking regulations. Dykes had been a trucker but had been let go over an argument with his boss. Dykes was 65 years old and job prospects were slim for him. Dykes had been married but wasn't in contact with his ex-wife or either of his two adult daughters. Some other topics that Dykes opened up about was his dislike of TV talk show hosts like Oprah and Jerry Springer. He talked about gay marriage, loose dogs that he referred to as a plague, the idiots in the FBI, and a long, long list of indignities that Dykes felt were all the fault of the U.S. government. It was now 4 days into the standoff. The story had been picked up nationally, and the sheriff's office was inundated with phone calls and emails from people who offered to take Ethan's place as the hostage. When the word got out that Dykes wanted a reporter, there were several that stepped up and volunteered. While it was a noble gesture, the police didn't want to give Dykes another person that could become a second hostage. And as we have seen in other cases, tragedies like Chuck's murder and the kidnapping of Ethan bring all sorts of armchair detectives out of hiding. And FBI agents called people who offered unsolicited rescue plans the Good Ideas Club. Some of the proposals that they heard were to pump sleeping gas into the bunker. But that sleeping gas trick was tried during a 2002 hostage situation in Moscow, Russia, when militants took over a movie theater. And guess what? 100 innocent people died. Another suggestion the FBI received was to deliver drugged food to Dykes. But they dismissed that idea quickly because they couldn't guarantee Ethan wouldn't eat it. Then there were the wannabe heroes that literally showed up to the location trying to rush in and perform the rescue themselves. One dude arrived on scene wearing full military uniform and sporting a beret. He said he could storm the bunker and save the day. But there was one little problem. This guy wasn't Special Forces. He was a member of a militia organization in Alabama and referred to himself as Colonel Crusher. Oh my gosh, that's just hilarious. Another guy got there dressed as a Texas Ranger. In real life, he was a community college security guard. Police promptly sent both of these men away. While some of the cops had to turn away the crazies, the real professionals were doing their jobs. The lead profiler studied the video from the school bus when Dykes shot Chuck Poland, and he listened to hours of negotiations recorded during the standoff. She determined that Dykes was a promise keeper because he promised that he would shoot Chuck if he didn't hand over the kids. Then Dykes made good on his promise when Chuck refused to hand over a child. She also noted that if Dykes said he would kill Ethan, he probably would go through with it. The profile also labeled Dykes as an injustice collector, someone who holds grudges and spends their entire lives stewing over perceived wrongs, some perceived wrongs which may have taken place years earlier. On the fifth day of the standoff, Cindy Dykes, Jimmy Lee Dykes' oldest daughter, was picked up by FBI agents in Florida. Cindy was now 36 years old and hadn't spoken to her father in nearly 25 years. She had no idea what to expect, but imagined herself taking Ethan's place as the hostage inside the bunker. And as she left her home in Florida, she told her kids goodbye because she wasn't sure if she would ever return. The FBI brought Cindy to Midland City, where they put her up in a hotel under a fake name. They wanted her there in case they needed her to speak to her father. Cindy's memories of her father were of his explosive temper, his racism, and his preference for guns and booze. Cindy's mother, Nelda Lukers, divorced Dykes when Cindy was 3 years old after years of domestic violence following Dykes' drunken rages. Nelda would say that she truly loved Dykes, but she knew that if she stayed, he would have killed her. Cindy even recalled that Dykes put Nelda in the hospital quite a few times. For the first few years after the divorce, Cindy lived with her mother, but when she turned 10 years old, she moved to Texas to live with her father for a year. Days into the hostage negotiation, and Dykes was unraveling quickly. His moods were swinging wildly from calm to enraged. He would make threats during his bouts of anger. Lieutenant Rafferty was doing his best to keep Dykes from completely losing it. Being able to talk Dykes down was getting harder and harder to do as the hours passed. It didn't help when the press started interviewing his neighbors. Dykes saw a broadcast when a woman told a reporter that Dykes was, quote, a time bomb waiting to go off. Her words didn't help the situation and instead added fuel to his hate fire. To try to calm Dykes, who they now knew was watching everything that they were doing on the news, during a press conference, the sheriff's department thanked Dykes, quote, for taking care of our child. Every day at 1 p.m., Dykes would open the hatch so the FBI could deliver Ethan's medicine. On the fourth day, he was able to spy a SWAT team's rifle through the crack in the hatch. And again, he was pissed. He went back down the ladder and could be seen on the hidden camera holding his pistol and pacing back and forth. He called Lieutenant Rafferty on the drop phone, raging and in tears. On the hidden camera, they could see Ethan sitting on one of the bunks watching TV. Dykes told Lieutenant Rafferty that Ethan knew how to fire the air rifle and detonate the bomb. He told Rafferty, if I'm dead, the kid's going to have access to this trigger. He went on, quote, if I fall dead and blood goes every goddamn where, he's going to have access to that weapon and he's very likely going to get to it and pull that trigger before they will be able to come through that door, end quote. So basically, during the hostage negotiation, what Dykes made clear is that he had instructed Ethan that if Dykes fell to the ground, Ethan was to press a button, basically detonating himself. Lieutenant Rafferty assured Dykes, saying, we don't want that to happen. I don't want you to tarnish your message. He told Dykes that the SWAT team had been pulled from the medicine delivery duty, but Dykes couldn't be placated. He told Rafferty, that trigger-happy son of a bitch, he may think he's Rambo and he may think he's going to be a hero if he does that, but he's not going to be no goddamn hero when the world knows he's responsible for killing this kid. So real quick, during their investigation in Alabama, authorities went through Dykes' trash. In the trash, they found two receipts, each containing items that appeared to be for the purpose of making a bomb. Back in Quantico, Virginia, FBI technicians purchased those same exact items on the receipts, specifically from Home Depot and Walmart, and they wanted to replicate the second bomb that Dykes had inside the bunker. With the products that they bought, they were able to build six pipe bombs using pieces of PVC pipe filled with gunpowder and taped to a propane bottle. Technicians thought that Dykes would detonate the second bomb by shooting an air gun projectile into a shotgun shell primer that was embedded into the pipe's end cap. They took the replicas into an open field and detonated them one by one. Each pipe sent PVC shrapnel flying, along with flames from the gunpowder. With the setup they created, they thought it would be a hard shot to hit the detonator with the air rifle. But if Dykes was able to hit it, the explosion would kill anyone inside. On the sixth day of the standoff, things continued to go downhill. Earlier in the week, through the secret camera, Dykes had been seen taking care of Ethan and almost seeming to be in a grandfatherly role with the little boy. But not anymore. On this day, as Dykes was walking around the bunker, Dykes stepped on a toy car that set off an outburst from Ethan that lasted an hour. Earlier in the week, Dykes would have comforted Ethan. Now, he just completely ignored the kid. Dykes told Lieutenant Rafferty that they had until 5:30 p.m. the next day to meet his demand, saying, I'm going to die in this hole. One of Dykes' demands was to have a second phone brought to the bunker so that he could speak directly to the press. He told Lieutenant Rafferty, I can call CNN. I can call every damn body possible. Later in the day, they could see Dykes practicing the motions needed to detonate the bomb. Everyone was losing patience. the FBI was ready to go in and extract Ethan. It was now Monday morning, February 4th, 2013, 7 days after the standoff began. A meeting was held with the lead FBI agent, the county sheriff, and the senior state patrol officer on the scene. They agreed that they had no choice. Negotiations were almost exhausted. They had one ace up their sleeve, Cindy, Dykes' daughter that was waiting for the word to try to talk to her father. The FBI picked her up and brought her to Lieutenant Rafferty to try to make a video call with Dykes. The FBI had rehearsed with her all weekend, with an agent playing the role of Dykes and trying to simulate his erratic behavior and hostility. They urged her not to say a word about her mother's passing weeks earlier because they feared that that would only set Dykes off. As Cindy left her hotel room, she brought pictures of her kids to show her dad and one of herself and her father together lighting sparklers from her childhood. She wanted to try to get him to surrender so that she could at least visit him in prison, and she wanted to tell him that she loved him. When Dykes found out he would be talking to his daughter, he was excited. He told Lieutenant Rafferty that he wanted to brush his hair and put on a different shirt before he spoke to her. At 3 p.m., two officers delivered a laptop to the bunker so that Dykes could do the video chat with Cindy. Dykes told them, "I'm going to need you guys to back away." He pulled the laptop inside the hatch and carried it down the ladder into the bunker, keeping the camera facing away from himself. As he went down, the camera showed the rungs of the ladder. He reached the bunker floor and said, "Hey, Bill," to Lieutenant Rafferty. Rafferty replied, "Your daughter Cynthia is here to talk to you." Dykes replied, "Oh, good." Cindy was listening and got all teary-eyed as she heard her father's voice for the first time in decades, but she never got the chance to talk to him. Because as soon as Dykes sat down to speak to his daughter, the breaching team set off an explosive that allowed the hatch to blow off, and the hatch flew in the air before landing back on top of the entry. Teams of FBI agents moved the hatch off of the entryway, and the first agent that was tasked to be the point placed the crossbar across the entrance and swung down into the hole. But instead of landing at the bottom of the 12-foot drop, his legs got caught up in something and stopped him halfway down. The next agent behind him landed on the point man's head and shoulders, causing the entire operation to halt. The second agent tried to push the first agent through whatever obstacle was stopping him. At that point, Dykes reached his arm around the corner and shot blindly at the agents coming down from the hatch. The first agent yelled back to the agents above him, "He's shooting at me! He's shooting at me!" The other agents pulled the first agent back out and the medic asked him if he was hit. He stood there and he was too pumped with adrenaline and answered back, "I don't know, you tell me." Thankfully, the medic didn't find any injuries. The shots had missed the first agent by mere inches and tore into the wood panels that lined the walls around the ladder. At that point, Dykes was still in the bunker. While down there, he pulled the string that was attached to the bomb in the PVC pipe that he had communications with, and shotgun pellets and shards of PVC pipe rained down across the property. And the concussion from the blast hit the agents who were around the entrance of the bunker. When the agent who was running point came back out of the hatch without Ethan, the contingent of FBI agents and local officers, they were devastated. Back at the hatch, they couldn't figure out what it was that was blocking their entry into the bunker. They decided to send down an attack dog on a leash. She was trained to go into tight spaces like holes to disable suspects, but panicked when she got stuck in the same spot as the first agent. They pulled her back up and finally saw what it was. Dykes had strung a web of steel cables between the ladder and the wall. Agents grabbed bolt cutters and used shotguns to cut and blast away the cables. As they worked, other agents dropped flash bomb grenades down into the bunker to try to disorient Dykes. It had been 4 minutes. Now, 4 minutes in a rescue mission is a long time. So it had been 4 minutes since they started the mission to rescue Ethan. Things had not gone the way that they had practiced, and as time ticked by, they feared what was happening down in the bunker. The first agent decided he needed to move. Holding his sidearm in one hand, he jumped feet first into the hole, bypassing the crossbar. His hope was that he would land on Dykes, but unfortunately, his arm hit the wall on the way down, and he dropped his pistol. His weapon was under the ladder, and he ended up on his rear in front of the ladder in the darkness. To compound the lack of visibility, the flashbang grenades had caused the bunker to fill with smoke. The agent got to his feet and charged forward, reaching for Dykes, but didn't find him. He leapt forward a second time and his hand touched hair. It was little Ethan. The agent pulled him against his chest and told Ethan he was going to be okay. In the instant the first agent hit the ground, he was followed by two more agents. As the first agent shielded Ethan, the other two confronted Dykes. They ended up in a struggle with Dykes and fired their gun at him, hitting him at least 12 times in the face, neck, chest, and hand. Just in case he was still capable of moving, they placed handcuffs on Dykes' body and then got Ethan up the ladder and handed him off to the medic. Ethan, when he got out, then asked, "Where's that man?" The medic told him, "Oh, Ethan, you're not going to see him anymore. He's gone." And as it turns out, Ethan was rescued 2 days before his 6th birthday. 2 days later, for Ethan's birthday, the lead FBI agent, the sheriff, the district attorney, and other law enforcement officers stuffed a cart full of toys and brought them to Ethan's birthday party. Ethan spent a night in the hospital before he was released to his mother. Ethan's kidnapping was officially over. And the man responsible, Jimmy Lee Dykes, was dead. So, who was Jimmy Lee Dykes? Jimmy Lee Dykes had served in the Navy in aviation maintenance from 1964 to 1969. He did some time in Vietnam and received an honorable discharge from the Navy. He received the Vietnam Service Medal and Good Conduct Medal during his service. Interestingly, the man Dykes killed, the bus driver Chuck Poland, he was also a veteran and was also in aviation maintenance. Chuck had served in the Army as a helicopter mechanic. Chuck loved working as a bus driver, and he was dedicated to keeping the children on his bus safe and in line. He kept his bus well-maintained and would watch the security footage at night to see what went on that he missed while he was driving. If he noticed any infractions or shenanigans, he would give the kids a warning, but if they did it again, he would turn them in. According to Chuck's widow, Jan, it bothered her husband of 43 years when he had to tell the school about a discipline issue with one of the kids on the bus. So, to avoid this, Chuck used creative methods to keep the kids in line, like slowing the bus to a crawl on the route home if someone was misbehaving. He knew every one of the kids by name and brought them Little Debbie cakes and talked Jan into baking treats for them. In looking into Chuck's origin story just a little bit, I learned that in true military fashion, he asked his wife Jan to marry him just 3 weeks after they met. Jan said that Chuck was her hero. 5 years after Chuck's murder, Jan told the Dothan Eagle that she credits her faith in sustaining her through her loss. Quote, "My advice to anyone who goes through anything like this would be to turn to the Lord if you don't know him. I ask him to be my strength, and he is," end quote. The day before his death, Chuck had felt that Dykes needed a friend, so he made an effort to be one for him. That day, after Chuck left him the note, Dykes put the note in his wallet but gave the jam away to a neighbor. Chuck was 66 years old when he was murdered and was loved by many, including his wife, children, and grandchildren. During the standoff, his son Aaron told NBC News that his dad gave his life protecting the kids on the bus. Quote, "He considered them all his children, all 22 of them, and I know that's the reason why my dad took those shots for his children, just like he would do for me and my sister," end quote. Chuck's daughter, Lydia Hancock, told CBS, quote, "Daddy was a lot of things in the 66 years he was here on this earth. He was a brother, a son, a daddy, a husband, and a grandfather. Pawpaw. Everybody just, he was funny, lovable, caring, just, I mean, there's not another person like him," end quote. Chuck Poland's memorial service was attended by hundreds of people. His family eulogized him, saying, quote, "His life lived for the purpose of loving and caring for people, culminated with the same purpose evident," end quote. The stretch of highway where the church that served as a law enforcement and FBI headquarters during the standoff was named the Charles Poland Jr. Memorial Highway. Many of you might be wondering about Ethan, the little boy who was held hostage. As I mentioned earlier, Ethan had been living in foster care. After his kidnapping, he was placed with his biological mother, Jennifer Kirtland, briefly. They made an appearance on the Dr. Phil show, but Ethan's time with his mother was short-lived. Soon, he went to live with his grandmother until she passed away, and then he lived with his 18-year-old brother for some time. But eventually, little Ethan was back in the foster system. But thanks to Judy Walding, the Houston County Department of Human Resources supervisor, Ethan was placed with and formally adopted by Reverend Brandon Turner and his wife, Nikki, who had fostered Ethan when he was a toddler. Ethan would no longer have to worry about not having a family. He is now formally Ethan Turner, and he joins a house full of 10 kids total. Thankfully, of the ordeal, Ethan doesn't remember all the details, but he told WSFA News 5 years after his rescue that he remembered some. Quote, "I remember I looked up and I got snatched up. The guy dropped me and then dropped his gun. He picked me back up. I was trying to run, but I didn't have time," end quote. In that 2018 article, Ethan told the reporter, quote, "It was just bad. I'm still here and I'm still alive," end quote. His parents said that he prays for the Poland family and for Chuck whenever they pray. In an article from 2002, it said that Ethan had adjusted well and was doing fine in school. After Charles Chuck Poland was killed, the Alabama legislature passed the Charles Poland Law, making it a crime for any parent or adult to board a school bus without the permission from the bus driver. On February 12, 2013, Honorable Martha Roby in the House of Representatives remembered Chuck Poland in the Congressional Record. She spoke about Chuck, saying he was born in Idaho, served in the Army, and how he made Southeast Alabama his home in the 60s. He retired from his work as a diesel mechanic and picked up bus driving part-time until he was asked to join the team full-time in 2009. Honorable Roby said that because of Chuck, the kids will have an opportunity to live a full life. One of them might grow up to be a scientist or a business owner or even a soldier. And all of this is due to Chuck, who was willing to give his life for the children. The author Joseph Campbell wrote, quote, "A hero is someone who has given his or her life to something bigger than oneself," end quote. Honorable Roby finished by saying, "Today we recognize a true hero. Chuck Poland gave his life so that others may live, and for that, he will always be remembered." How in the world did something like this happen? I'm so grateful that little Ethan is okay, and my heart truly goes out to Chuck's family. But man, he was such a brave human. Go figure that today's story included veterans on both sides of the good guy, bad guy card, right? It sounds to me that Dykes was suffering from some sort of mental health crisis, but also he appeared to just be a violent offender from the jump, especially with the claims of domestic abuse. All right, thank you all for listening today, and be sure to join me next week for another episode. Shout out to my girl Myrtle for researching and writing today's episode. My sources for today's case include The Wall Street Journal, ABC and CBS News, Time Magazine, Alabama.com, WDHN-ABC, The Florida Times Union, The Dothan Eagle, and Psychology Today. Military Murder was created by Mama Margot Productions. The music was created by Tyops. Until next time, remember, you never really know what someone is capable of, so remain vigilant always. You have a fabulous week, and I'll keep digging to bring you another military murder story next week.
Mama's working on her podcast.
I don't want to.